This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Welcome to Critics at Large, a podcast from The New Yorker. I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
And I'm Vincent Cunningham. Now, we're all staff writers at The New Yorker.
That's right.
That's right. That's who we are. And each week on this show, we make sense of what's happening in the culture right now and how we got here. How you guys doing?
Doing great.
Doing well. Yeah, doing okay.
You're lowering the bar
well
and I'm raising
like
it.
Well, seems like a qualification from great.
The sun is shining and we're alive.
That's true.
A lot to be said for that.
Well, in light of that, the other day, right, I sat down and I watched the new Dave Chappelle special that came out on New Year's Eve. It's called The Dreamer, and it's the latest in this sort of run of specials that Chappelle has done with Netflix. The Dreamer starts with a long story that I was really enjoying for a while. He's talking about meeting Jim Carrey on the set of
Man on the Moon,
mm-hmm. his sort of biopic of Andy Kaufman, which he was like famously method acting.
And when he walked into the room where we were supposed to meet, I screamed, "Jim Carrey!" And everyone said, "No! Call him Andy." And I didn't understand. And then he came over
and talking about how weird it was to meet Jim Carrey but not meet Jim Carrey. But it ends up being, of course, a kind of allegory about something that Dave Chappelle is, for whatever reason, now obsessed with, trans people.
I could see he was Jim Carrey. Anyway, I say all that to say, that's how trans people make me feel.
And if that sounds disappointing to you, then that is a metaphor for how you will feel about the entire special, I think. Two things struck me about the special. First, it's yet another example of an endless, often annoying conversation, right, about what you're supposed to say, what you're allowed to say in comedy, as a comedian.
Yeah.
This complaint of, you know, you can't joke about anything anymore, right? And second, the special is, like, incredibly self-referential. You can
yes.
only really understand it mm-hmm. if you've been paying close attention to Dave Chappelle for the past, like, 5 years or so.
Yeah.
For me, it brought up this question about comedy that seems especially unresolved these days. What is the figure of the comedian for?
Mm.
What do audiences or just maybe society want them to do?
Yeah.
That anxiety has become almost a subject of stand-up itself. Is that kind of in line with what you've been noticing recently?
Yeah, definitely. I think, on the one hand, what you say about Chappelle specifically about kind of like pushing the boundaries of what you're allowed to say or not and dealing with cancel culture. I think that's something that Chappelle is like maybe number one in, but there's also Ricky Gervais, who just also had a Netflix special come out recently.
My last show, Supernature, dropped on Netflix last year. Big backlash, wasn't there? Big backlash. People going, "You can't say that." You can. I did.
And I think just generally the question of what is a comedian for would seem to be quite simple on the face of it, right? A comedian
I wish,
is,
yeah.
Right? A comedian is for making us laugh.
Right.
Right? I think it's probably never been that easy, you know?
Right.
But I think now it's even more complicated for a variety of reasons, first among which is the sort of like political valence of comedy in the midst of kind of a culture wars
yeah.
moment or a renewed culture wars moment.
Alex, is this like part of your experience of comedy these days?
the question of what the comedian is for.
What it's for, and this anxiety being part of the substance of the special itself.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, it may also be for one very simple reason, which is that there are more comedians. There are more performances going on. Like, they're on all the streaming services. Netflix is putting out a new special, it seems like, every day. And so if you want to get your the word about you out, I think you kind of have to make a convincing case to the audience that you're standing for something. And I think there's that anxiety maybe baked in these days.
That's a really good point.
So what I want to do this episode along those lines is trace how our expectations of comedians have changed over the years, and then maybe talk about some of the new comedy we're seeing now, just because I think that on the one hand, it's pushing the form to really unusual and interesting places, but also it's exposing some growing pains, some fissures that might help us understand what comedy means, is supposed to do in today's world. So that's today on Critics at Large. What is the comic for? Okay, so let's start by looking at some of the specials that have come out recently. We'll start with Dave Chappelle just because I mentioned him and I think he is an emblem of something. The new special he released on Netflix, as I mentioned, is called The Dreamer. What did you guys think about that?
Well,
that might be my complete thought, but go ahead.
I mean, the main, you know, the first order of business with comedy and with stand-up comedy more particularly is, am I laughing?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, before watching the Chappelle special, I had heard a lot of talk about it. You know, this is something that is, you know, a kind of a hot button comedy special because of all of the trans jokes and the path Chappelle has been taking along those lines over the past few years. But I attempted to come to it with an open mind. You know, mm-hmm. I was just like, I'm going to sit and I'm going to laugh. If I'm going to laugh, I'm going to let myself laugh. You know, I wasn't like, OK, I'm going to kind of be overdetermined in my expectations. And I really did not crack a smile, which I felt really sad about. But I just it just wasn't funny to me at all. Like at all. Like shockingly, you know, like stone faced.
We mostly agree about this.
Yeah.
Alex, was this kind of where you landed? Where were you on this?
So I want to try to parse out for myself where I landed on this with your help. Like, can you guys help me a bit? I'm trying to make sense of the experience of having seen this. So what Nomi has been saying is that Chappelle has become known over the past few years for jokes that the trans community, or many people in the trans community, have taken as attacks. And, like, I think it's important to say that there's just been a huge furor around the jokes that Chappelle has been making about trans people. Like, not only are people saying that they're unfunny, but people are also saying that it makes them feel unsafe, that Chappelle is, like, opening the Overton window when it comes to what can and can't be said about trans people, that
That's
basically
right.
he's, like, some of the more you know, some of the harsher critiques of his comedy have been that it's actually causing harm in society. And that has gotten my attention and made me curious, but also has made me nervous to engage with it. And of course, like, Vincent, I'm guessing this is the case for you. I also have, you know, I don't think Chappelle's on a pedestal for me anymore, but, like, certainly from the era of the Chappelle Show, like, you know, his groundbreaking sketch comedy series, like, at the, when that came out, they're kind of – Chappelle could do no harm.
That's
like,
right.
He was the funniest person alive, it seemed like. So I was very curious about my own reaction. What would it be like to finally, like, sit down with this guy who once really made me laugh and confront something I was nervous about? So the first joke, which you described, Vincent, totally, like, pulled the rug out from under me. I did not see the punchline coming. This long, heartfelt joke that's about him meeting Jim Carrey and having to call Jim Carrey Andy Kaufman because Jim Carrey is super method, and it ending up becoming a punchline about trans people. Whoa.
Yeah.
And I just felt really deflated by that joke, I would say, which kind of became true of the special for me in general. And the deflation had to do with this sense of, okay, you really want to define your audience in a really specific way. Like, I didn't see a huge difference between that and, like, MAGA stuff, to be honest with you. I don't think it's that like courageous or saying things we can't hear. I just think it's about telling a certain kind of person, like, you don't want to hear this. I'm going to tell it to you anyway. But there are a ton of people who do want to hear it.
But they're all in his audience.
They're all in his audience. And he has huge audiences. He's like a mega best-selling comedian. So I more felt like, oh, you're making this like really easy for yourself. And then the rest of the special, to me, was, again, all about, you know, Dave Chappelle trying to deal with what it feels like to be Dave Chappelle. A lot of it is about talking about the Chris Rock slap and his own relationship to Chris Rock and what he would have done if he were in the, you know, the position of being slapped. And a lot of it is about him getting attacked at one of his own shows. And it's kind of like he's returning to this, you know, he's literally alone on a stage.
Yeah. It's like almost a semi-round, semi-in-the-round.
A semi-in-the-round experience with him, right, with him almost in this, yeah, like very small space carved out of a bigger stage. I'm just going on about this in the attempt to explain, I think, that like that's kind of what stand-up comedy is. It's about being the one against the many and trying to get the many on your side. But everyone walking in that room is kind of already on Dave's side.
Right.
And so I think what's going on with the trans jokes in part is this like very weird power battle that is non-ending, that's just – it's almost like an arm wrestle. Like if I can just get you guys to laugh at yourselves and I'll declare to win and I'll ease up on you.
Right.
And instead, weirdly, I feel like he's coming out the strange loser in this battle because the jokes aren't getting funnier, but he is getting more desperate to make them land.
You know, Julia Kristeva, this book, you might want to read it. It's about the abjection that is I think this is kind of what we're talking about. That is like, you know, whether it was Jewish people, black people, the beginning of stand-up comedy as we know it, people that were vulnerable because of their position in society, coming before an audience and sort of wrestling back some kind of control, but through the necessary abjection, right? And then we can think about another special that we all recently watched. It's called Get on Your Knees. This is a one-woman play-turned-comedy special written and performed by Jacqueline Novak. She wears in this special a gray, shapeless T-shirt, the kind that, you know, we kind of recognize from teenage girls everywhere trying to hide whatever developments might lie beneath.
A puberty special.
That's a puberty special. That's right. And it is a very verbally precise, breathless, essayistic. It is stand-up, but it's also a kind of monologue about the blowjob and its place in a young girl's life.
Mm-hmm.
The penis's vulnerability is something I've been aware of for some time, really since, I don't know, age 11 when I started reading these magazines with these articles, headlines on the cover, How to Please Your Man. They broke the story every month and I'd flip to the article to see if there was anything new. And it always kind of came down to a list of instructions about how not to injure the tender penis, you know? I remember specifically this, a careful near the tip. It's extremely sensitive. Like you can't imagine a part of the body as sensitive as the tip of a penis. And it's like, oh God, I must be very sensitive then. And that's the first thing I'm gonna run into on the penis. Like in my approach, I have to land gingerly because that's the most sensitive part. It's like, shouldn't you bury that treasure somewhere deeper in the castle?
Maybe in contrast to the Chappelle, maybe not. What did you guys think about this? I know that one of the ways that she's presented this is theatrically at Cherry Lane Theater. And Alex, in your role as theater critic, you reviewed this show. I wonder maybe if you could talk about that experience and then watching the special.
That's true. So I've seen Get on Your Knees 3 times now, including the special. I reviewed it. I absolutely loved it. I went back to see it again, chasing the high. You know, it's and one thing that I do love about Get on Your Knees is that it is so verbal and it goes so fast. And so much of what she is working with are defamiliarizing things that, you know, actually to go back to Nomi talking about Viktor Shklovsky last week. She's defamiliarizing, you know, basically like expectations around sexual coming of age. And it goes in all different directions from her own experience just to like the language we use to refer to the genitals, to refer to sex acts, like the kind of received, extremely cliched ways that we've come to think about these things. She makes them strange and fresh and therefore very funny again.
Well, as someone who came to it as a first-time listener, I just did not enjoy it. And this Ooh. Is a very this is very tough, right? Because and this is part of what stand-up does.
I love when we disagree. Let's
yeah,
go.
Yeah, yeah. This is what stand-up does. It's like it does make you uncomfortable if it's like, you know, about something that should indict you mm-hmm. or should, you know, point the finger mm-hmm. at you. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Perhaps you're not laughing is evidence of something sinister within you. So this whole thing that's like sort of puncturing holes in the male ego. Instead of doggy style, she calls it what? The style of the hound.
The hound's way.
The hound's way. She has all these like really interesting, she sort of turns around the idea of the erection. She said, that's not a building I'd walk into. Like, I don't think that thing is up to code.
Right, right.
These funny things about, so, you know,
she calls the person, the penis Susan.
She calls the penis.
It's like a feminized, the most feminized organ,
right.
You know, on a male body.
Right. All these interesting things. And I thought they were amazing turns of phrase. And
yeah.
I would have enjoyed them more if they were presented to me not on like a David Sedaris essay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It just, and maybe reading it would have made me more alive. And she makes, you know, she makes lots of little literary references. She's like approaching, giving her first blowjob. She's thinking of Vladimir Nabokov. She, at one point, she says, you know, the toothless, smooth blowjob is the hobgoblin of little minds, mm-hmm. which is a quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson about a slavish consistency. Mm-hmm. All these kinds of things, which were interesting to me and impressive to me, that's what I thought the laughs were. Like, wow.
Yeah.
Listen to that.
Yeah.
But I could not, I do like to get my yucks in. I was like,
I do love yucks as well.
So much like Nomi in front of Chappelle, Jacqueline Nova gave you not a single laugh.
She gave me, I had
scant laughs.
Scant laughs. Maybe I had a chuckle, but I really was just like.
It's more of a chuckle vibe.
I want to know where Nomi.
Okay,
now
should
I know.
Please jump in.
Okay, should I be a tiebreaker? Okay, I will say in terms of yucks.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna yuck meter in terms of the yuck meter. I'm gonna now seem like a person who laughs not once at any kind of comedy.
We've seen Nomi laugh. Let's just say
Nomi has a great laugh.
If you want to get a notary in here, I'll sign some document. That's completely fine.
I was like, okay, this is an achievement. This is an impressive achievement. I think it's super smart. I think it's making me think about things. In a different way.
Yeah.
Is it making me laugh? LAFF? Not really.
Right.
And, you know, Vincent, your point about, and I think it's generally obviously like an interesting point about watching comedy, about who is the watcher and who is the performer and
That's
the
right.
relationship between them and, you know, thinking about like, whether you relate or not to the comedian in terms of your identity and so on. So, you know, for you, you are a man. You are a man.
I am.
regrettably,
let's face it.
Regrettably, you're a man or unregrettably, not regrettably. So your relationship to the material was a particular one, right? And I watched it and I'm like, okay, I should like, in a different way, I was like, I'm like an uptight Jewish lady who's like smart.
Yeah.
Yeah, I should love this. But maybe it's like too close to home. You know what I mean? Because I too am like cerebral about sex. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Or like I'm like maybe this is making me feel like uncomfortable identification in some way.
Yeah.
You know, I mean that might enter into it too, which is yeah, like I said, a question in with comedic performance.
One thing that struck me, and maybe it's because it was so essayistic. Like, if we're thinking about this role thing, I think this was the great utility of this special. Like, that it was something that either you could be alienated from it, but also, like, it could be a site of identification for you. And maybe, like, that's one of the new places, one of the new things that stand-up might be.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she seems so much more of a protagonist than usually the stand-up is, like, a kind of antagonist almost to the audience, someone who is working something out. Here, putting oneself forward as a protagonist, come along with me on this journey and see what we can like kind of glean together. In a minute, the long, 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 long history of comedy, free speech, and the culture wars. Critics at Large from The New Yorker will be right back.
Hi, I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker and host of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast. On the podcast, I ask a great contemporary writer to select a favorite story from the magazine's almost 100-year archive to read and discuss. Together, we delve into the story, exploring its themes, its style, and what makes fiction work. You can listen to authors like Otessa Moshfegh talk about why we write.
Story, or attaching a story or creating a story, is this inclination that we all have to stop spinning.
And you can hear writers like George Saunders discuss the nature of storytelling.
On the first read, you accept these things as descriptions and they make you see the scene, but every line is a chance to inflect the reader's mind.
You'll discover new favorite authors and read old favorites in new ways. Episodes of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast are released on the first of every month. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on credit worthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
So trying to figure this thing out, especially when it comes to sort of outrage and speech and what we can or cannot say, I read this book. It's called Outrageous, A History of Showbiz and the Culture Wars. It's by a writer named Cliff Nesteroff. Here, this is really more of an encyclopedia of showbiz and the culture wars, where he's just telling you decade by decade where free speech, whatever culture war is happening at the time, and the sort of contingencies of a moment have come together with respect to comedy and showbiz, right? If there is an argument, just by laying this stuff out, maybe the argument is it is very silly to talk about what you can and cannot say now, since that has been the subtext and sometimes the text of comedy for a century now. Mm. So maybe that's the argument. You know?
So you mean that, like, in the way that comedians, as we were talking about before, that a certain strain of comedians, the Chappelles and the Gervaises, like to say, you can't say anything anymore, that's just kind of always been with us.
It's always been with us. Right? He starts, you know, in the 1910s with vaudeville, which is the, mm-hmm. if there is any sort of ancestor to stand-up comedy, it's vaudeville. In vaudeville, it was really interesting that there were these different circuits that were managed by different people, and they all had their own rules and regulations. It's like, you know, in this state, you cannot talk about sex at all. You can't, you know, you can't talk about sex. You can't talk about race or whatever. There were all these different prohibitions. One big thing, of course, was ethnic stereotype at a time when the country is being flooded with new immigrants all the time. There's Italians, there's Irish. And unfailingly, once an ethnic group becomes more and more sort of embedded into the culture, this is something that Nesteroff does point out, at a certain point, they say, okay, enough ragging on us, right?
Okay, so this is very interesting what you're saying, because you're talking about two different kinds of prohibitions, and I feel that contemporary comics who say that they feel censored often conflate the two.
Yeah. That's right. Mm-hmm.
One is official prohibition, and even just your saying it makes me want to hear a bunch of jokes about all those things. Like someone official saying, you can't tell a sex joke, of course you want to tell a sex joke. Like,
right.
Obviously.
Of course.
The other one is about social standing and a sense that people no longer want to be the butt of a joke and made fun of, and that it might behoove the comedian not to make fun of them, maybe because they want to include those people in their audience, or maybe, honestly, just because of market pressures, more people find it less funny. So, you know, your audience is not telling you you can't do something. Your audience just isn't with you if you do it, so you may want to change your act.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, those are two totally different things.
There's this anecdote about, like, sort of at the turn of the century, this group called the Russell Brothers, they sort of dressed in drag, and their act was called the Irish Servant Girls, and they were doing Irish stereotypes. And the crowd I think it's overstated. They called it a riot, but these people were hissed off the stage. Things thrown, like the plurality of the crowd that was Irish said no more, you know, and that this happened over and over. Whether we're talking about blackface, whether we're talking about sort of racist comedy, especially at the end of World War II when the veterans come home and there's this like recrudescence of racist comedy and the people with new social standing and new ideas of themselves as Americans saying no more. Mm-hmm. There's another anecdote about Lucille Ball is pregnant on the I Love Lucy show, one of my favorite, something that I was like absolutely raised on. My mother was obsessed with Lucille Ball. She gets pregnant and Desi Arnaz is like, we're going to do a show and she's going to be pregnant in the show because we can't hide it. And people are sending, men and women are sending letters saying it's disgusting that Lucy's having babies. Like
the network freaked out. The network didn't want to air Lucy being pregnant because it implies sex. Yeah.
Yeah. So it seems to me just as you mentioned, there's two things about.
And they were a married couple.
I just love that that's how the television networks found out how babies were made.
I know. How do you think all these people are here? But it's like.
Your viewers came into the world in a very similar way.
Yeah. If I could, you know, you mentioned two different kinds of things that are conflated. If I had to articulate that, I would say pressures over depiction. Like,
right.
Here's a pregnant woman. So depiction on the one hand and denigration on the other hand, right?
Yeah.
Totally different things. What can you show, which is like, you know, what censorship comes from, and then people perceiving themselves rightly or wrongly to be denigrated and this from the ground up lodging their complaints with comedians. It's two very different kinds of pressures.
Yeah.
You know, all that, you know, this nexus, very hard to navigate. Reminds me of one of my favorite comedians who is George Carlin. And I know, Nomi, you watched both of you guys actually have watched George Carlin's American Dream, a two-part miniseries on HBO about, by Judd Apatow and Michael Bonfilio.
I saw it when it came out.
Yeah, this came out in 2022, I believe. And it's a two-part documentary. Each part is 2 hours long. I think Carlin is a really... obviously a legendary figure in stand-up comedy and kind of like was active for nearly 50 years, you know, since the early 60s when he was about 20 or in his early 20s until his death in 2008. And, you know, Carlin famously reinvented himself as a comic. And it's interesting to me just what the documentary did for me is kind of show how important comedy can be as a kind of weather vane for the times. I think one of the more interesting parts of the documentary is when they talk about Carlin in the early 70s, where he kind of turned countercultural and was talking about the seven dirty words you can't say on TV.
Yeah.
And I wanted to know the ones that you could never say on television. I mean the filthy words that are always filthy. There are a lot of these little two-way double entendre words that have two meanings, words that are okay part of the time. I call them like part-time filth. Some of these words, they're only 50% dirty. You have words like ass. Ass is hardly even a dirty word anymore, but it has a few meanings that you can't say on television. That's what I was talking about. What can you say on television? That's another one of those places where we can't use these words all the time. But some of them are all right some of the time. Ass is all right on television. You can say on television things like, well, you've made a perfect ass of yourself tonight. But you can't say, hey, let's go get some ass.
Wait, I wrote a list down. Okay,
please
it's
say it.
Shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, motherfucker, and tits.
Yeah.
Cursing, cussing, swearing, and all I could think of was shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, motherfucker, and tits.
A lot, you know, there's a lot of talking heads on the documentary, and all of them kind of grew up with Carlin and talk about how definitive and how important that moment was, you know, just listening to Carlin kind of like flay open that those kind of conventions or even sometimes laws. And I was thinking to myself, it's interesting, you know, because now we wouldn't really bat an eye. You know, it just also made me think about how contextual comedy is, you know?
Yeah, it's
looking,
about moments.
Yeah, you're looking for the fault line and you're looking to step over
which,
it.
Which changes
right.
over time.
I mean, I think that has a lot to do also with the later comedy of Carl and Nomi, which I think set a certain vision for what the comic should do in America. And that is of the social critic of the state. Like what Carlin is doing at the end of his life is basically getting up on stage and saying the United States is a warmongering, you know, nation that is ignoring the needs of its own people. And he's being an angry prophet.
The only true lasting American value that's left, buying things, buying things. People spending money they don't have on things they don't need. Money they don't have on things they don't need so they can max out their credit cards and spend the rest of their lives paying 18% interest on something that costs $12.50. And they didn't like it when they got it home anyway. Not too bright, folks.
Like, a lot of it is being an angry prophet. And often he was very funny doing that.
Right.
But that was a big part of what he's doing. And so, you know, you hit 9/11, post-9/11 culture, where, like, that then becomes the comic's role to sort of say, you know what, guys? What if we're not always the good guys? And what if we're doing things wrong? And from there you get the huge success of someone like Jon Stewart, who is able to kind of combine both roles on Comedy Central in a fake news show that nonetheless, as we all know, delivers the news to many people and manages to be a kind of alternate truth teller for during an era riddled with lies and weird patriotic propaganda.
You'd be right. This morning, President Bush unveiled his proposed war budget at the Pentagon for the first time, putting a dollar amount on the cost of Operation Iraqi Freedom. All right, Mr. President, let's see the bill.
Today, I'm sending the Congress a wartime supplemental appropriations request of $74.7 billion.
$74.7 billion? Let me see that check. Okay, hold on a second. $74.7. Rumsfeld, did you order the extra missiles? Is that you?
And then, you know, the fact that, like, that kind of comedy has been less successful recently. We're just in a very different era. There is, I think, you know, and again, I think it all keeps coming back to that Chappelle special and, like, what Chappelle's trying to do. We're not really in an era, I think, where there is, like, a big mainstream America and then people who feel kind of like we're trying to fight that thing. It feels much more just kind of split in two. And so when it's more split in two, it's easier both for you to say as the comic, yeah, everyone's against me, but I come here on my side. But it's also easier if you're not on that team to perceive it as just like, oh, you're just preaching to your own choir again. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Definitely.
Like right now, I think we're in a big preaching to your own choir moment when it comes to political comedy.
And
not a revolutionary statement,
right.
But it's hard to like revitalize that form.
It's less about
under current conditions.
Yeah, it's less about breaking down the mythologies of the state and more about, like, if you agree with me, you know, again, this kind of identification, you know, watching becomes a badge. It's almost like a bumper sticker of who you are and what you believe. So us, you know, the audience out there in the seats, are we a community? Are we a crowd? Or are we a mob? All that and more in a minute on Critics at Large.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.
So I keep thinking about the audience and what the audience is. I can't help but think that there is something going on with the composition of an audience that itself affects comedy and the role of the comic. You know, I dipped into another book on comedy recently, which is called Comedy Book by Jesse David Fox, who writes about comedy for Vulture. And he starts his book by talking about different theories of comedy, what makes comedy work, and he lands on this idea of play, that comedy allows us to play, to kind of go back to this childlike state where we can experiment with things and have fun with things, and that the act of playing or being in the presence of play, which I guess is what you might feel like if you're watching good stand-up, makes us into a community. And it's that thing, community, that is giving me a little bit of pause when it comes to comedy. Because on the one hand, nothing is more bonding than finding the same thing funny as someone else.
Yeah.
But the thing that's giving me pause specifically is that, you know, we are living in such a time of communal division where it's really like, you know, it really just society feels divided. I think we all know this, that it does create, if you want to, you know, preach to a community, there really is a big risk of preaching to the choir. And to me, that doesn't sharpen comedy or like make comedy more interesting or more fun or play the role of or let the comedian play the role of the truth teller. It is itself a kind of invitation to comedic laziness. Which can also, and here I'm going to take a big old swing, be moral laziness. And the reason why it can be moral laziness is that I think one role of the comic is to look at the, you know, Naomi was talking about fault lines before. It is to look at the fault lines of society, and it's to step on them, I think, to find out if they're arbitrary or not. Are they there for a good reason or not?
Yeah.
And if they're not there for a good reason, then you want to tap dance all over them. Then that is, you get to be the exemplar of the taboo breaker. You get to have the freedom, and I think this is another reason people love comedy, that most people can't afford themselves. Most people can't go around saying the taboo breaking thing because it's simply not done.
Right.
But the comic can, and when the comic gives voice to that for a lot of people, something very exciting can happen. But by the same token, the comic who feels that he's or she is doing that, but is actually just playing into like a very common talking line. Again, I'm just keep coming back to Chappelle with the trans stuff. It's like, I think if you're watching it, you know, even if you're not trans, if you're just watching it kind of attuned to that experience, you're thinking like, there literally is nothing new here. This is just mean, nasty discourse. So you're not turning anything on its head. You're just participating in it, but you're saying that you're breaking all these boundaries.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just couldn't believe I was watching it and I was like, oh, I'm looking forward at least to an attempt to make this new somehow, this like discourse. You know what I mean? Because that's how it's presented. I'm going to, and then like the joke is like, oh my God, like, how can you be a woman if you have a dick? You know, stuff like that. And I was like, what? Like, this is what you're,
it's, this is exactly.
The joke?
It, exactly. And it just like, makes me wonder, like, is community in comedy always a net positive? I mean, I hate to come back to Trump and MAGA and all this stuff, but I do think humor is a big bonding force. People laughing at other people we saw it in 2016, we're seeing it again now, is like a big bonding force at the kind of classic MAGA rally, just like finding someone else to point and laugh at. And that element is also part of what it means to be in the audience, you know, in a comedic audience. It can be. And so like some of the great comics play with it by directing, you know, that communal feeling back onto themselves.
Yeah,
like
I'm thinking
of a special I really liked recently that I think you guys have seen also is John Mulaney's special
from last year. Yeah.
Which is called Baby J, where he talks about having gone to rehab. And what makes that special funny is he's kind of taking it. I mean, I think he's really playing into the utmost level of being alone on a stage with a bunch of people around you. You know, he's exposing some ugly stuff about himself. There's a long story about buying and selling a Rolex watch in order to buy cocaine. And I was listening to that story and thinking like, ooh, this is bad. Like, wow, this man was really in a bad way. And like, yeah, it's funny, but it's also dark as hell. Yeah. And he's kind of getting the audience together and allowing himself to be laughed at in a way that may be therapeutic for him, but is also like pretty bracing, I think.
Yeah.
So I appreciated that special.
Yeah, one of the tag of that whole story about the Rolex watch is, now if you think that I'm terrible and desperate and I'm unlikable in this story, just remember, this is one that I'm willing to tell you.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I agree, Alex. And when you were talking about like the sort of like punching, quote unquote, punching down and making fun in order to form a kind of community of ugliness. I was thinking about Mulaney because I do think Mulaney, I finally something I laughed at, you guys, everybody, like breathe a sigh of relief.
I really thought it was a good special.
I thought it was like both super smart and sort of like viscerally funny. And famously Mulaney was sort of like America's sweetheart, you know, the sort of like wife guy who was like clean cut and like, you know, and then he obviously had this like very publicly explosive scandal, you know, broke up with his wife, went to rehab, was revealed to have had a really bad coke and other drugs problem. And I thought, you know, I have a friend who told me recently she was visiting a friend of hers in rehab and that they were showing the Mulaney special in rehab, oh, which wow. I thought was really an interesting kind of
Hall of Mirrors
tidbit.
That's really interesting.
Because that's a different kind of community, right? It's a community of recovery. And I could see how important, as they say, you can't be it if you can't see it. You know, seeing this, you know, figure that puts himself up for kind of examination, right? Or puts his own story of kind of descent into drugs and recovery up for viewing. So it kind of surprised me, but also made sense that what we glean from it isn't just laughs, but also a kind of like lesson, which I don't know that this was like Mulaney's intention in any way. But it was just curious to me to learn from this friend that this is something that happens.
Well, it's so interesting. I think this goes right back to Alex's question about who the audience is. Like that image of people in rehab listening to a comic talking about rehab actually goes back to Jesse David Fox's book, because the rhythm that he sketches out about the figure again of the stand-up comic is, okay, you have the 50s and 60s where suddenly there's a coffee house culture, which meant that you could speak to what Fox talks about as like-minded audiences and therefore work out things from a persona that sort of mirrored perhaps the attitudes and sensibilities of the viewer.
To your niche. You speak to your niche.
This is Lenny Bruce. This is Mort Saul. Moves forward into what they call, for better or worse, the 80s comedy boom. A bunch of comedy clubs that are franchised across the country. He has a quote in there from Mark Maron, famous from his podcast, WTF. Maron has this quote in there that's like, franchise comedy clubs begat franchise comics. So all of a sudden it's like cheap Jack Nicholson impressions and all this kinds of just weird hack material, right? That like sort of is there so that it can appeal to everybody. And then what happens is like that becomes so bad that like the boom is over. Nobody goes anymore. Stand-up comedy sort of collapses in the 90s. And then there's this thing called alternative comedy.
Yes.
For me, the signpost of that will always be Janine Garofalo, and she's mentioned here. I she's one of the first comics that I
love, you know, her.
Growing up looking at Comedy Central, just thinking she was so smart and cool. But what his point is that she does these like references, and it's clearly for an in-crowd. It's like, who are these people that like Hootie the Blowfish and Dave Matthews Band? I know that you probably like Friends, don't you? And you probably, you know, talking about. Almost the comedy is about your consumption being a sign of who you are. It was about we're all the kind of people that wear like chunky glasses and Doc Martens or whatever.
We're all individuals.
Gen X, disaffected.
We're all individuals.
All, you know, post Carlin, wearing flannel, tired of America and willing to tell you about it. So I think this is one of the big dialectics, right? Like something that tries to reconstitute a large public becomes watered down and leads to something that's more like an in-group enclave, right? Mm-hmm. And if anything, I think, you know, we're always kind of talking about this in one way or another. The algorithm, the Spotify, the streaming or whatever has intensified that, right? So I think we're in a moment of extreme...
The boundaries of your group just become reinforced.
That's right.
You mean.
Yeah. Like identification, right? If you like this, you might like is almost like the signpost and the watchword of today's stand-up comedy.
Well, yeah. I got to tell you guys, I mean, look, I know that I'm the big pro-Jacqueline Novak person in this room, and I find her funny, and the others who don't, and that's fine. But I will just say, I think she has found an interesting fault line in her own audience that she plays with. And we were talking about before about, you know, her being willing to be this figure, putting herself forward as this figure of projection. And part of it is just like a very classic line between men and women where
100%.
She's sort of saying like, yeah, like, you know, a lot of what she's talking about, a young woman in the suburbs or frankly anywhere, just like being like, OK, I'm going to sexually come of age, but how does it happen? Is super relatable
right.
to, you 100%. Know, the women in the room. Yeah. And then the other half of it is just like imagining herself into the male mind and their expectations. And so those guys are there and like probably much like the guys in her show, kind of feeling misunderstood by the way that they're being addressed.
Yeah.
And that's part of what's funny, that like they – that, you know, the audience itself is divided and allowed at the end to kind of merge with itself and become one. Maybe that sounds totally like hooey-gooey, but
– No, I totally – yeah.
A transformation takes place that kind of divides that audience and then pushes them together by kind of defying their expectations and uniting them around something else. And that's a cool way to do it.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, you know – it's different than politics because I don't know if you're going to get a politically mixed crowd at any of these, you know. I don't know. Can you guys think of like a comedian who has a really politically mixed audience base? There might be.
Somebody who'd like people that don't make us laugh. Like, so for example, for me, the person that's trying to do this right now and who I has over the years stopped making me laugh is Kevin Hart.
Mm.
You know, he's a... He is a, at this point, a rock star. You know, he does arenas,
yeah.
which only a few comedians can do or do even attempt to do. But I think you risk not saying anything and the sort of the view from nowhere. So I think it's always a problem. I think this thing, you know, you're so right about like, I think people come into audiences, whether they're a community or not, with real intention now in a way. I think they know what they're coming to see. Jesse yes. David Fox talks about the emergence of the comedy nerd, right? Somebody who has opinions about comedy, knows who they're going to see and what the vibe is before they get there. One really telling thing to me in the profile that Carrie Batten did.
Carrie Batten's profile, our colleague Carrie Batten profiled Jacqueline Novak recently in The New Yorker.
It's a wonderful profile. It's talking about the period before she reaches her success and her friend John Early, who also directed the stage version of the show, he says, as a kind of lament, like, okay, all of us remember Jacqueline doing her stuff and thinking that she was brilliant, but she's doing them at these bars and in front of these audiences that are, one, drunk, and he says, not there in good faith, which to me is such a new idea in comedy. Like, the point is, like, yeah, they're drunk and you're supposed to get them,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But it's like, nope, whatever comedy is now needs willing and like almost like predetermined audiences, people that are there to pay attention to a certain kind of thing, which I don't think is salutary or not, but it's certainly new. And I think if what we want is a kind of shattering of the whatever mythologies surround us, maybe it's not best for that, even if it is great for, you know, turning on Netflix and having a great time.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting. The sort of like preemptive nichification, you know, of audiences, like from the get-go.
So maybe just a way to sort of we've been talking about what the comic is for. Maybe just to land this, a more personal question: what these days do you want comedy to be when you search out a comedy special, which I do multiple times a week? What do you hope for comedy?
I want to laugh, I want to think a little bit, and I want to forget.
mm-hmm. The trifecta.
Forgetting is, it's entertainment. I want to forget my troubles a little bit.
There have been a lot of times when I've laughed at comedy specials recently, but I'm trying to analyze for myself and failing at one that made me laugh really hard. Jenny Slate did a special a couple of years ago, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. There was just one joke she did about being a little kid who was terrified of like dealing with a nightmare. You know, it just rearticulated this kind of big experience of childhood. And I guess that's what it is. It's seeing fresh. I do think it's about having your expectations defied by seeing something fresh, you know, in a way that just turns it all on its head.
Yeah. For me, the image for me that maybe answers my own question is when I was a kid, Chris Rock's Bigger and Blacker came out, the special, but then also the CD version. So I would put in this CD and like put it on low and like sit right next to it.
That's so cute.
And crack up. But that image of like listening to other people laugh, laughing along, but also being alone. I belong to some audience. I'm also here thinking, you know, that it brings me into a certain kind of community, but also makes me reflect that I'm two things at once. And those two things are really what I'm always wanting.
You know, nailed it.
Alone,
as usual, nailed
together.
It. Mm. Alone together. Maybe continue as such. Alone together. Or the subtitle of this
maybe
podcast.
Maybe you, listener, are alone together listening to this fairy podcast.
Yes.
Yeah. Before we go, we want to give you listeners a heads up on a show we're putting together in honor of one of the most maligned days of the year. Yes, my friends, Valentine's Day.
Yeah, we are not playing into all of this, you know, chocolates, candies,
flowers.
Nonsense. Oh, please. We are going to do an episode about stories of wretched love, by which we mean, you know, love that's gone horribly awry.
And we want your help. We want to know what your favorite wretched love story is and why. I mean, it could be a book, could be a movie, could be a country song, a graphic novel. I don't know. Just surprise us. Tell us your top wretched love story and why you love it. You can write to us at themail@newyorker.com and include the word critics in the subject line. Or, even better, send us a voicemail.
Oh, yes. We've showed you ours. Now show us yours.
Ooh,
that's
la
right.
La, Alex.
Get involved.
Give us a call at 347-464-1476 and leave us a voicemail letting us know your favorite wretched love story and a bit about why you love it.
And keep a lookout for that episode a few weeks down the line.
Thank you.
See you
next time.
See you soon.
This has been Critics at Large. Our senior producer is Rhiannon Corby, and Alex Barish is our consulting editor. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Alexis Quadrado composed our theme music, and we had engineering help today from Jake Loomis with mixing by Mike Kutchman. You can find every episode of Critics at Large at newyorker.com/critics. We'll be looking for your wretched love story submissions. Email them to us at themail@newyorker.com with the subject line, Critics. Or leave us a voicemail at 347-464-1476, a very four-heavy number. See you next Thursday.
Hi, I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker. Each week on the Writer's Voice podcast, New Yorker fiction writers read their newly published stories from the magazine. You can hear from authors like Colson Whitehead.
Turner nudged Elwood, who had a look of horror on his face. They saw it. Griff wasn't going down. He was going to go for it, no matter what happened after.
Or Joy Williams.
Her father was silent. Slowly, he passed his hand over his hair. This usually meant that he was traveling to a place immune to her presence, a place that indeed contradicted her presence. She might as well go to lunch.
Listen to new stories or dive into our archive of great fiction. You can find the work of your favorite fiction writers and discover new ones. Listen and follow The Writer's Voice wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.